On behalf of the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, welcome to today's training, a decision framework for applying monitored natural attenuation processes to metals and rads and groundwater. My name is Julianna Cheatham. I'm coming to you from Roxborough, North Carolina. I'm going to serve as a moderator on today's call. I'm going to cover some introductory material in the next few slides and then quickly turn the training over to our instructors from the ITRC Attenuation Processes for Metals and Rads team. As listed on the slide, today's training course is based on the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance, a decision framework for applying monitored natural attenuation processes to metals and radionuclides in groundwater. We call it the APMR-1 document. Today's training is an introduction to this document, and we do encourage you to review the document itself. And at the end of the class, we'll take you to a link where you can go to the ITRC website and download a PDF of the full document. We also make available the presentation that you'll see during today's training class. In the downloaded version of the presentation, in addition to what's on the slides, we also have a notes section with additional information. So at the end of the training class, we will take you to a link both where you can download the document as well as the presentation that you've seen during the training class. Today's training is sponsored by the Interstate Technology and Regulatory Council, ITRC, and is hosted by the U.S. EPA Cleanup Information Network, CLUIN. Please move to slide 2. If you're using the CLUIN system, there's a series of orange buttons along the top that allow you to navigate, and most often you'll use the third button, a single right arrow, to move forward through the presentation. Today's class is scheduled for 2.25 hours. For our phone line participants, I have started out with all lines muted so we eliminate background noise. During the question and answer breaks, you are welcome to unmute your line, and that's by selecting *6, and you can ask questions out loud. For our simulcast participants, if you'd like to ask a question, it's the orange question mark button at the top of the slide that allows you to send in questions. Anyone is welcome to use that question mark button at any time during today's presentation to send in a question or a comment. As we move through the slides, each of you are in control of what slide you're on. The slide number is listed in the upper left-hand corner, and the instructors are going to say that slide number as they go through the presentation. Most often, you'll use the single right arrow button, the third button along the top, to move forward one slide at a time through the presentation. We also have a list of slide numbers along the left. That's especially useful during the question and answer break, so you can jump back if someone refers to a slide. On our last slide, we provide a link to our feedback form, and we do ask that everyone on today's call take just a few minutes to give us your feedback. We use the information and do appreciate you taking the time to give us your feedback. Today's event is being recorded, and we offer archives of past ITRC training classes. On slide 3, this is our disclaimer and copyright that we include in all ITRC training presentations, and ask that you please read over the slide. In short, it says we try to provide accurate and reliable information, but do not warranty this material. We recommend you check with local, state, and federal laws, as well as experts. ITRC does not endorse any specific products. ITRC's presentations and documents are copyrighted, so please ask permission before using. On slide 4, this is information about ITRC, and I do encourage you to visit the ITRC website, www.itrcweb.org, to learn more. ITRC is hosted by the Environmental Council of States. Overall, ITRC is a network that's led by state regulators. It includes federal partners from Department of Energy, Defense, and the Environmental Protection Agency, as well as members from industry, academia, and community stakeholders. This diverse group works together, and they address a wide variety of topics that may focus on a type of technology or a type of site, and they communicate their results through technical and regulatory guidance documents and internet-based and classroom training. On slide 5, you can see some examples of the topics that ITRC has addressed recently. These are the topics that we have training in 2011. We continue to offer popular courses from previous years, as well as develop new classes each year. ITRC offers internet-based classes, as well as classroom training. We're working on our schedule for 2012, and when that becomes available, it's going to be on the ITRC website. I encourage you to go to the ITRC website to learn more about all the topics that are available. There's guidance documents, there's archives of training classes. You can also learn more about how you can become more involved in ITRC. On slide 6, I'll introduce our instructors. Our instructors are members of the ITRC Attenuation Processes for Metals and Rads team. The team is led by Carl Spring from the Colorado Department of Public Health and Environment, and Deb Goswami from the Washington State Department of Ecology. Ann Charles is a research scientist with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection in Trenton. She works for the Bureau of Environmental Evaluation and Risk Assessment, overseeing publicly funded investigations and remediations that include radionuclide contaminated sites. Jennifer Nyman is a senior project engineer in Emeryville, California with Arcadis. She specializes in the characterization and remediation of groundwater sediment and is a recognized expert on the topics of bioremediation and metals rads contamination. Brian Finnan is not available today, so his backup is going to fill in, so thanks to that. Miles Dimon is a fellow scientist at the Savannah River National Laboratory in Aiken, South Carolina. His research focuses primarily on geochemistry associated with remediation of metals and rad contaminants in soil and groundwater. He's been instrumental in developing innovative treatments for metals and rads, including mercury, uranium, strontium-90, and iodine-129. Karen Vangelist is a fellow engineer at the Savannah River National Laboratory in Aiken, South Carolina. Her work involves managing two applied research efforts, one developing enhanced attenuation approaches for chlorinated solvents, and the other is a broad research initiative developing an approach as well as tools and treatment technologies for groundwater contaminated with metals and rads. If you move to slide 7, I'll now turn today's presentation over to Ann Charles from the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Ann?
Thank you, Juliana. Welcome, everyone. Thanks for taking the time out of your day to join us. Our training today is to teach you a decision framework for applying attenuation processes to sites with metals and radionuclide contamination in groundwater. And the APMR team, we do have a lot of experience dealing with long-lived contaminants, as we're an outgrowth of the radionuclides team, which formed back in 1999. We identified that regulators and the regulated community are looking for a consistent technical approach to figure out whether an attenuation-based remedy for metals and rads is appropriate. We published our first guidance document, and we're now offering training that you're receiving today on the document. Let's go ahead to slide 8. And let's start in first by identifying the problem. There are many sites contaminated with metals and or radionuclides. What you're looking at is a graphic from our document. It's showing you numbers of NPL sites with metals or rad groundwater contamination. What I want you to grasp from this is a nationwide problem, has sites in all of our regions, and what you're looking at is just for Superfund sites. So these are long-lived contaminants that cannot be physically destroyed, and what we're faced with is intractable site closure. Go ahead to slide 9, please. Now, what's the result? Well, if you are a site owner, operator, or a contractor working on the site, you're going to be trying to figure out how are you going to remediate the site. And you're likely going to be considering proposals for remediation that incorporate attenuation-based remedies. If you're a regulator like I am, you're going to be tasked with reviewing these proposals. So how will you be figuring out on a technically sound basis whether an attenuation-based remedy is appropriate for your project? Slide 10, please. And that is why we're here today. We're going to be teaching you a decision framework and how to apply that framework. We'll be building your scientific and your regulatory knowledge so that you can evaluate whether monitored natural attenuation for metals or rads in groundwater is appropriate for your site. And the trainers, including myself, we're going to be referring to monitored natural attenuation as MNA. Now, we do expect that regulators will benefit from the training, as well as site owners and operators, contractors, and stakeholders. Natural attenuation is a controversial and contentious issue, so I want to take this head on And let's start by clearing up a misconception about what M&A is not. It is not an alternative where we do nothing. It has to be based on strong science, extensive characterization, probably even more so than on sites contaminated with organics. So we're going to be teaching you about that. And in addition to the technical side, you're going to need to understand the regulatory policies and guidance because there's a lot of variability out there. So we'll be instructing you about that as well. The photo you're looking at on this slide, by the way, is from the Weldon Springs site. That's a DOE site near St. Louis. And you can see some site characterization being performed. You can go ahead to slide 11. This is a quick piece of business side. This slide is explaining for you the definitions that we'll be using for monitored natural attenuation and enhanced attenuation. M&A refers to the EPA-defined term, natural attenuation occurring without an engineered intervention, whereas enhanced attenuation uses engineered technologies to assist naturally occurring attenuation mechanisms to be sustainable, thus transitioning the site into M&A. Now, our guidance document has the complete definitions for you. I have them in the speaker notes as well. Let's go ahead to slide 12. And let's talk about what types of sites this would apply to. It certainly does apply to facilities involved in nuclear production activities, but there is a lot of other sites with rad or metals contamination. So think about the processes that result in situations where, for example, metals may be leaching the groundwater. And things that come to mind, you certainly have landfills and lagoons, tailings from mining operations. You'll be having sites where pesticides and herbicides were applied. And then there are the industries that use metals for manufacturing, plating, and electronics. So bottom line, there are many sites with the potential for metals or rad contamination, and there are many types of waste release scenarios. Let's go ahead to slide 13, please. What you'll also want to think about is the typical contaminants that you encounter on your sites. I've listed a few on this slide. Now, EPA has M&A guidance that you'll be hearing about in the upcoming module of today's training. EPA's guidance addresses radioactive and non-radioactive contaminants. They're highlighted on this slide, and this graphic is also in our guidance document. Your own site specifics may have other rads or metals contamination. What you'll be learning today does apply to them as well. But I do need to point out that our guidance does not cover perchlorate and nitrate because the attenuation processes are significantly different from the other metals and rads. Slide 14, please. I've been talking about the decision framework, and here's a preview of the decision framework that you're going to be learning about. The framework is an iterative process. We're looking at the whole system's investigative and remediation strategy rather than a piecemeal approach. And importantly, it's a process that emphasizes the collection of dispensable data for characterization as well as in the monitoring phase. Now, the graphic you're seeing on this slide is a simplified version of the full framework that has a lot more details, and it's discussed in detail in Chapter 3 of our document, Figure 3.1. So when we get to Module 3 of today's training, Karen's going to take you through the framework steps plus the details of the types of data that you'll be collecting and evaluating. If you haven't done so already, as Juliana mentioned, we do encourage you to have a copy of that full framework available before we get to Module 3. Let's go ahead to slide 15. And this is the roadmap for today's training. It's based on our guidance document that you see on the slide. Module 1 is going to be providing you with an understanding of the regulatory considerations and possible regulatory constraints. In Module 2, we'll be teaching you about attenuation processes. So this is going to be an important geochemistry refresher because metals and rads are not subject to the traditional attenuation processes that you're probably a little bit more familiar with on your sites with organic contaminants. The modules 1 and 2 are going to help build your understanding of MNA, and then in module 3, we'll go into the details of that decision framework using the principles that you will have just learned about in the prior modules. Throughout the training, we'll be presenting case studies. You will notice that the case studies don't precisely follow the framework. That's because the cases do predate the framework. They're still going to give you an understanding, though, of real-world applications. So with that, let's go ahead to slide 16, and I'll turn the presentation over to Jennifer Nyman from Arcadis. Jen?
Thanks, Ann. So in this module, the first module, I'm going to be talking, as Ann mentioned, about the regulations that are related to MNA, and it will also make the case that MNA is a viable remedial alternative for metals and radionuclides. Let's go to slide 17. As Ann mentioned, one barrier to acceptance of this remedy is that it's a pretty controversial remedy. There is a perception out there that it's a do-nothing approach, or that parties are walking away from the site by using MNA. And what we found is that some of these perceptions might result just from a lack of experience with metals and radionuclides or with applying MNA to these contaminants. So there's a need for consistent policies and training on this topic, which is what we're providing here. So in this module, we're going to talk about the regulatory systems that relate to this remedy, and we'll also talk about factors that affect regulatory acceptance of MNA for metals and radionuclides. We're also going to go through the relative advantages and challenges of MNA, and these must be openly addressed and discussed in order for all of the stakeholders invested in a particular site to come to an agreement that this is appropriate for the site. Let's go to slide 18 and start with federal regulatory systems with authority over MNA. And one of the key documents that relates to MNA is shown here on this slide, and that's the 1999 EPA OSWER Directive on MNA. And this document lays out the expectations for MNA in general. It mentions metals and radionuclides as contaminants potentially amenable to MNA, but it doesn't provide any specific guidance or technical background specific to metals and radionuclides. Of course, other policies related to site remediation would also apply when MNA is part of a remedy. So, for example, the CERCLA policies will still apply if you have a Superfund site. And we do expect an actual EPA policy on MNA of metals and radionuclides to be forthcoming. So keep an eye out for that. Slide 19. And while EPA hasn't issued its official guidance, its official policy on metals and radionuclides, it has issued some technical background on this document. And that technical background came in 3 volumes, and they're shown here on this slide. The first 2 volumes were released in 2007, and the third was released just last year in 2010. And so these documents provide very important technical background on attenuation processes for metals and radionuclides, as well as the other inorganic contaminants that Ann mentioned. And so these will be very important references for you. If you haven't already, we encourage you to go to the website that's listed on the slide and download these documents. They have chapters that address each individual metal and radionuclide, so they're really handy. Let's go to slide 20 and talk about state regulatory systems with authority over MNA. What we found when we looked at the state regulations with respect to this remedy was that MNA really wasn't an available remedy historically when the regulations were written, but it can fit the intent of the existing regulations. In our TechReg document in section 4.2, we provide the details of policies for 7 different states as they relate to MNA. What we found when we pulled together this information was that there was an extremely variable policy between the states with regard to MNA. Some states, like Illinois, do not allow MNA even for organic compounds, while in New York, MNA is allowed for metals and radionuclides on a case-by-case basis. In no case, though, did we find that a state has an official written policy on this remedy. Let's go to slide 21. We wanted to find out a little bit more about how states were addressing MNA of metals and rads, so we conducted actually 2 surveys of state regulators. And some of the key results of our surveys are listed here. The responding states are shown in color on the map on this slide. what we found was that, as I said on the last slide, there's very little official M&A guidance when it comes to metals and radionuclides. But M&A is selected on a case-by-case basis at some sites. We did also find that M&A has been applied at metal or radionuclide contaminated sites in 17 out of 24 of the states that responded to the survey. And those states are shown in green on this figure. And that's a really key finding, because this means that M&A is capable of satisfying the regulatory requirements for metals and radionuclides in groundwater. Note that when M&A was applied to metals and rad contamination in these states, the application didn't follow the framework that you'll see in this training, because the application of M&A predated the framework. And so overall, we also found that improved policies and guidelines are definitely needed for M&A of metals and radionuclides. In general, there's just not a lot of knowledge about how to apply this approach to these contaminants. And if you want any more details on the survey, see section 4.1 of our take rig document or appendix D, and we provide the answers to all the questions that we asked during the survey in those sections. Next, let's go to slide 22 and talk about what factors affect the regulatory acceptance of M&A. And this list of factors is based on the results of our surveys of state regulators, a 2005 working group that was convened to address this specific topic, and the general consensus of our ITRC team. And the importance of each of these factors will depend on site-specific conditions, like hydrogeology. And this list obviously isn't exhaustive. So we're going to talk about the first three factors first on this slide. And removal of the source of the contamination is definitely considered a prerequisite to M&A. The site must be adequately characterized, and the contaminant plume must be stable or shrinking. And all of these factors are specified in the 1999 OSWIR directive that I discussed earlier. So now let's go to slide 23 and talk about a case study that illustrates these first three factors. And this case study deals with a uranium plume at Hanford, Washington. And at Hanford, M&A was selected as an interim remedy for uranium in 1996. And if you'll look at the graph on this slide, uranium concentrations up until about 1996 were actually declining to below the drinking water standard, the MCL for uranium, which is 30 parts per billion. So it was assumed that M&A was actively attenuating uranium at this site. However, after 1995, you can see that the uranium concentrations increased, indicating that the plume was definitely unstable. Further investigation was conducted, and it was found that the increases in the uranium concentration were coincident with increases in the elevation of the water table. And the water level is shown on blue on this slide. It was found that the water table was influenced by the nearby Columbia River stage, and that as the water level increased, it mobilized some residual sources of uranium in the vadose zone, and that resulted in increases in uranium concentration down gradient. So this indicates also that the source wasn't completely removed. There were still residual sources in the vadose zone, and that this site wasn't adequately characterized. There wasn't a complete understanding of the interaction of between hydrogeology and the contaminant being transported. And so this is a case study where we have lessons learned with respect to M&A. And while it wasn't a successful application of M&A to metals or radionuclides, we can still take away some lessons from it. Note that they obviously didn't use the framework that we're presenting here in this training when they selected M&A, but the use of the framework definitely would have helped in this case. Slide 24, let's finish off the list of factors that affect regulatory acceptance. The stability of the end products of the attenuation process is a key factor affecting regulatory acceptance. Metals do not degrade in the subsurface as a result of attenuation. They'll still be in the subsurface, and it's important that in their attenuated form, they're stable over the long term. The availability of other remedies is another factor that can affect acceptance. If there are other viable, cost-effective remedies available, then M&A may not be the first choice. But what we find is that we have a lot of plumes out there that are relatively large or of low concentration or just aren't very accessible. And M&A is active, and it is a viable remedy for these plumes. The time frame and the attenuation capacity are other important factors. The attenuation capacity of the aquifer to remove contaminant from groundwater must be sufficient to last for the full projected time frame of the remedy. And you'll hear more about how to determine attenuation capacity in the subsequent modules. There must be a robust and site-specific monitoring program as part of an M&A remedy. And there must also be a contingency plan in case of deviation from expected results. In some cases, there should also be institutional controls in place to prevent exposure to the contamination while the attenuation processes are active. Slide 25. Next, we're going to talk about some of the advantages of M&A for metals and radionuclides. And one key advantage is that less remediation waste may be generated as a result of incorporating M&A into a remedy. We're going to go to a case study to illustrate this first factor, and then we'll come back to this list of advantages. So let's go to slide 26. This case study is the F area seepage basins at Savannah River. And at this site, acidic nuclear waste were disposed of in seepage basins, which are shown on the left-hand side of the figure on this slide. And these seepage basins weren't lined, so over time, contamination seeped into groundwater. And the contaminants of concern at this site include strontium-90, which is radioactive, and uranium isotopes. And at this site, a pump and treat system was installed, but it was found that the above ground treatment system was not removing all of the contaminants of concern, and that the system was generating a very large amount of radioactive waste that required disposal. It was generating about 5,000 cubic feet per year. And this disposal came at a high cost, and it also resulted in more exposure to the contaminants. So site personnel developed an approach for this site that was consistent with the framework that you have in front of you. And they selected an enhanced attenuation remedy. And this remedy involved adding base into the subsurface in a permeable reactive barrier approach. And so you can see that area of base addition on the right-hand side of the figure on the slide. And this base addition resulted in pH elevation. It also increased the pH of mineral surfaces in the subsurface. And once this happened, strontium and uranium were removed out of groundwater by adsorption onto the solid surfaces in this reactive zone. So they were removed from groundwater before the groundwater discharged the surface water, which is a nearby stream. So this is an example of the application of enhanced attenuation, not specifically monitored natural attenuation, but the lessons that we have from this site are also applicable to M&A as well. And at this site, also note that institutional controls are in place, and so they are preventing exposure to the contamination that is upgradient of the reactive zone. Slide 27, let's finish off the list of advantages of M&A for metals and radionuclides. As the previous case study also showed, when M&A is part of a remedy, the contaminants remain in the subsurface, so there's less cross-media transfer of contaminants and also a reduced risk of human exposure. An M&A remedy typically has less intrusion into the subsurface and fewer structures on the subsurface, or on the surface, excuse me. And so because of that, often the footprint of the M&A remedy is smaller than for other more active remedies. And we're seeing this as some of us are doing green remediation analyses of various remedial alternatives. Often the M&A remedy is one of the greenest remedial alternatives. M&A is typically used in combination with other remedial measures. One reason for this is, as I mentioned before, the source must be treated before M&A can be considered as part of the remedy. And so in this way, M&A is pretty flexible. It can be used for portions of the plume or sequentially in time. And then typically, when M&A is included as part of the remedy, the overall remediation cost will be lower. So this can be a key advantage as well. On slide 28, we list some of the key challenges of M&A for metals and radionuclides. As Ann already mentioned, the site characterization effort for M&A for metals and rads can be very significant. It's generally going to be greater than the cost of M&A for organic compounds. And so even though I mentioned before that by using M&A you can lower the overall cost for a remedy, there might be more cost that's actually upfront and spent on this characterization effort. When we're looking at M&A for metals and RAS, we often characterize the solid surfaces, which is not something we typically do when we consider M&A for organic compounds. And so this might mean that we would do X-ray diffraction to determine what kind of minerals are in the subsurface. We might also do selective extractions to find out how the contaminant is being bound to the solid phase as a result of an attenuation process. The next challenge of M&A for metals and radionuclides is that metals in particular will persist in the subsurface after the attenuation process. So it's very important to make sure that the metals are going to be immobilized over the long term and under natural geochemical conditions, because these are the conditions that the subsurface is going to return to over time. There must be a robust and site-specific long-term monitoring plan in place to implement M&A. And the time frame for M&A for metals and RAS can be longer than if you're using another more active remedy. And then, as we discussed earlier, one barrier to implementing this remedy is a perception. And so in some cases, education and outreach efforts will be required to fill any gaps in understanding and to build a common view of all of these advantages and disadvantages of M&A for metals and RAS. So let's talk a little bit more about that on slide 29. And on this slide, we list some stakeholder issues. Stakeholders typically want minimal exposure and acceptable risk to the contaminants, a return to the usefulness of the site, long-term monitoring and, in some cases, institutional controls where they are appropriate, and a well-defined contingency plan. And the monitoring and the contingency plan are requirements that are specified in the EPA technical background documents that were released in 2007. So they should be part of any M&A plan. And the values and concerns of tribal nations may differ from those considered in standard assessments. For example, flora and fauna with religious importance may not be considered in a standard risk assessment. So it's important to keep those issues in mind as well. And if you want any more information on tribal and stakeholder issues and how they relate to M&A, you can see Section 5 of our TechReg document. So on slide 30, we're going to summarize the key points of this module. M&A is usually employed with other remedial technologies. In this case, it's pretty flexible. And it's important to keep in mind that some source treatment is typically going to be required along with M&A. M&A for metals and RADs is capable of satisfying regulatory requirements, so it is a viable remedy. It has associated advantages and challenges, as we reviewed. And improved guidelines are needed to ensure a consistent application of this remedy, and that it's a knowledge-based remedy built on a thorough scientific analysis, and that's what we're trying to provide here today. So now we're going to move to Module 2, and I'll turn it over to Miles.
Thank you, Jennifer. This module is going to be a brief overview of the kind of science that Anne and Jennifer have talked about that we need to understand in order to apply M&A. If we'll move to slide 32, what we're going to learn in this module is about the attenuation processes for metals and radionuclides. We're going to present some understanding of or what needs to be understood about the relationship between attenuation processes and aquifer properties. We want to understand the reversibility of metals attenuation and the need for long-term monitoring. Again, as it's been mentioned, metals and radionuclides, except for those very short-lived radionuclides, are going to persist in the subsurface for a long period of time. So it's important that the processes that are holding them there are not reversed, and so we need to understand under what conditions that can happen. And then we'll look at a hypothetical case study of the co-precipitation of nickel with iron sulfide. Let's move to slide 33. The M&A processes that we typically talk about are precipitation and co-precipitation. These are processes in which a contaminant is bound into a solid phase, so it may be in the groundwater, chemical conditions in the groundwater change and cause the contaminant to either precipitate directly as a contaminant mineral, for example, lead might precipitate as a lead carbonate mineral, or it might co-precipitate in another mineral. So if iron, there was dissolved iron in the groundwater, and say chromium, then if the conditions change that cause the dissolved iron to precipitate as an iron hydroxide, the chromium would often co-precipitate in the iron hydroxide structure. Sorption is the attachment or binding of contaminants to mineral surfaces in the subsurface. Radioactive decay is, I think we're all familiar with, is an intrinsic property of the contaminant. It doesn't matter what the chemistry of the aquifer is. Each contaminant has a different half, each radioactive contaminant has a different half-life, some short and relevant, others like uranium are very long and are rarely relevant, and you would rarely rely on radioactive decay for uranium. Dilution and dispersion are physical processes rather than chemical in the aquifer. You may be familiar with those from understanding of organic contaminants. These are generally not recommended by regulatory authorities and EPA as mechanisms to rely on as your primary mechanism for M&A. What happens at most sites, though, is that sorption or precipitation and co-precipitation will be the dominant attenuation mechanisms. And what needs to be understood is the balance between the forces that tend to keep contaminants in solution versus the forces that tend to cause the contaminant to partition to the solid. Let's move to slide 34, please. And one of the key geochemical parameters that controls contaminant mobility and controls whether it binds to solids or not is pH. And pH is, chemically, it's the negative log of the activity of the hydrogen ion concentration. Activity is related to concentration, so because it's a negative log, when the hydrogen ion concentration is high, that means the pH is low. So pH of 7 is a neutral pH. So at pH is less than 7, groundwater is acidic. At pH is greater than 7, it's basic, or sometimes referred to as alkaline. On the right, you see some pHs of common substances. Most people know, lime juice is very sour, can be irritating. If you squirt a lime in your eye, it burns. That's because it's acidic. It has a pH around 2. Seawater has a pH of around 8. Ammonia cleansers are very good at dissolving things, and they have very high pHs, around 11. If you can look there, you'll see the range of natural groundwaters is typically somewhere between 5 and 8.5 or so. The other chemical parameter that we want to talk about is EH, or sometimes referred to as oxidation reduction potential. I should say EH is a form of oxidation reduction potential. It can also be related to the amount of dissolved oxygen in a solution. But it has a profound effect on contaminant behavior, in particular those contaminants that are subject to oxidation and reduction. When EH is at 0, that's typically sort of a neutral EH, and when EH is below 0, conditions are fairly reducing, and you would expect reduced forms of contaminants. When EH is above 0, you would expect oxidizing forms of contaminants. And on the right is just an example that I think we're all fairly familiar with, is the cycle of iron, and it illustrates the concept of oxidation and reduction very well. Iron, when it's mined, typically iron ore is an oxidized form of iron. It's an iron oxide. In order to make cast iron or steel, it's put at very reducing conditions or very low EHs, and iron is made, represented by the iron bar on the right at the low EH end. Well, then things are made out of that iron. So, for example, your car is made out of steel from that iron. That your car exists in an environment that's very oxidizing, is obviously full of oxygen in the air. So eventually, the undercarriage of your car will start to turn brown and red, and that's because that iron is reoxidizing. So you're at a very high EH condition or oxidizing condition. The iron is rusting and essentially turning back into iron ore. Well, EH and pH have a very important effect on contaminants in that they affect the contaminant valence state. If you remember your early chemistry, valence state refers to whether the charge on the ion of a contaminant. And it's important to note that both EH and pH help control the valence state of contaminants. We use diagrams that include both EH and pH, and called EH-pH diagrams, to depict just how many species and under what conditions species of a contaminant are likely to be dominant. So on the right there is an EH-pH diagram, and each of those red lines illustrates a reaction, a chemical reaction of one species, one dissolved species, going to another dissolved species. So in this case, we have arsenic species. The vertical lines are species that are not changing oxidation states or valence states, but are just going from having bound with one or more hydrogen ions. If you look at that gray line, that represents a oxidation reduction reaction. And the reaction is written on the left, which is the reduction of oxidized arsenic to reduced arsenic. And again, it's important to note that EH and pH both appear, the EH being the E minus in that reaction, both appear in that reaction, and that results in a diagonal line on that on the diagram to the right. Well, looking a little further at EH-pH diagrams and why it's important to understand the effects of EH and pH on contaminants, we can again use arsenic as an example. EH and pH, as I mentioned, define or control the dominance over what species are dominant in solution. So at oxidizing conditions and under the right pH conditions, arsenic will exist as a plus 5 species. When conditions are more reduced or EH is lower and pHs are more acidic, then arsenic will exist as a plus 3 species. This is important to arsenic mobility because arsenic 5 is much less mobile than arsenic 3. So it's important to understand those relationships between EH, pH, and a contaminant's behavior because they do affect the mobility of many contaminants. Let's move to slide 38 now, please, and look at the effect of redox potential, or EH, on solubility of minerals and how that can affect a contaminant. Here we have plotted on the y-axis is chromate or chromium concentrations. On the x-axis is pH, and we're showing two different EHs. The yellow field on that diagram represents a solid, chromium hydroxide, and the blue field represents dissolved chromium. On the far right, at the high pHs and high chromium concentrations, is chromate, which is typically the most toxic form of chromium. What you see under the oxidizing state, or on the left where the EH is 0.6 volts, is that the chromate field is very large, and the field of the dissolved, of the precipitated or solid chromium hydroxide is small. If you look at lowering the EH to 0.2, or the diagram on the right, the chromate field is smaller, so chromate is becoming less stable and is converting to chromium-3, which is precipitating as a solid chromium hydroxide. So that would be a very viable mechanism for attenuation of chromate. Well, Jennifer mentioned that it's important to look at surfaces of minerals in aquifers when you're talking about natural attenuation of metals and radionuclides. And the next slide, slide 39, shows why that is. And one of the reasons is because pH affects the chemistry of the surface of a mineral. So if you can use your imagination and think of those blue and green circles as a surface of a mineral, where the blue circles are oxygens and the green circles are a metal like an iron, so that would be an iron oxide surface. When you're at a very low pH, hydrogen ions are very abundant in the solution, and the hydrogen ions actually compete with metal ions that are positively charged, and the positively charged metal ions don't sorb to the surface of the mineral very well. And in fact, they're actually repelled by the positive charge on the mineral because of the sorption of the hydrogen ions. As pH increases to the right, there's less and less hydrogen ion in the solution or in the groundwater, so there's less hydrogen ion to compete with the sorption of the metal content, or the positively charged metals in the groundwater. And in addition, the surface of the minerals, because there's no hydrogen ions attaching to the surface of the minerals, are negatively charged and actually attract those metal ions, and sorption typically increases at high pHs. So that's just a rule of thumb. At low pHs, most metals and radionuclides are more mobile than they are at high pHs. Of course, there are exceptions to that. On slide 40, I want to talk about the variability of attenuation mechanisms with movement of groundwater or with changes in chemical conditions. So sorption, precipitation, and co-precipitation are all chemical reactions, and like all chemical reactions, the rate and the extent of the reaction depends strongly on the composition of the system. The system in natural aquifers or contaminated aquifers, the chemical conditions are always evolving. So that means that the adsorption, co-precipitation, or precipitation of contaminants can also be evolving. And so a groundwater that is moving in an oxidized regime may move into a wetlands or something where the groundwater is much more reduced, and different attenuation processes will occur. The picture on the right shows this very graphically with a glacier where groundwater is moving in the rocks under the glacier, had dissolved iron, plus two iron, in a reduced form. As that water comes to the surface at that edge of the glacier, it oxidizes to plus three iron, or ferric iron, and precipitates out as a rust-colored or very red iron hydroxide. A more familiar example of this might be, some of you might live in areas that have high iron in your tap water. And if you do, you know, you often have to battle the reddish-brown stains in your sink from the water that's moving in the pipes. As it moves in the pipes, it's dissolved in the plus two form. As it comes out and is exposed to the oxygen in the air, some of that iron in the water precipitates out as a stain on your sink. Absorption, as I mentioned in one of the earlier slides, is the partitioning of a contaminant from groundwater onto the surface of a mineral or, in some cases, organic matter in the aquifer. Common minerals that react in this way, that sorb contaminants, are clays, sometimes known as phyllosilicates. Oxyhydroxides are things like iron oxide, sulfides, carbonates. Natural organic matter can also sorb contaminants. And contaminants are, the degree of sorption of contaminants is often measured in terms of a KD. So you'll often see a reference to the KD of a contaminant, which is really just a partition coefficient, which measures how strongly that contaminant has sorbed to a mineral surface or to a soil. And that KD is simply the concentration of the contaminant in the soil over the concentration in the groundwater. So with some of those general chemical concepts behind us, let's move on to how the geochemistry of plumes can change. As I mentioned, all systems, subsurface systems, are continually evolving geochemically. A contaminant plume is a particular type of chemical evolution in an aquifer. It perturbs the natural conditions. And you can kind of think of this as a pendulum. So a pendulum, when it's hanging at natural conditions, hangs in a vertical position. If a force comes along and disturbs that pendulum or moves it away from those natural conditions, then it will always try to move back to that natural condition. So as long as that force is holding it there, it'll be off vertical, but when that force that's holding it is gone, the pendulum will return to vertical. That's kind of like a contaminant plume. A contaminant plume moves into an aquifer, as it changes the chemistry of that aquifer, and as long as that contaminant plume is there, the chemistry of that aquifer will be changed. But as soon as the source is cut off and the fresh groundwater moves in and pushes that contaminant plume out, the aquifer will start evolving back toward its natural conditions. And so this is a way we can understand geochemical evolution and the fact that those geochemical conditions are going to continue to change in an aquifer, and we have to understand that because that affects the reversibility of the attenuation processes. And just an example or a way to look at that is in terms of geochemical gradients. So as the plume comes into the aquifer, it reacts with the groundwater and minerals, and a leading geochemical gradient is set up where conditions on one side, the right side of the plume in this case, are the natural conditions, and they grade into the conditions dominant in the plume. And as I said, as the source is cut off and the plume moves away, a trailing gradient is created. And that trailing gradient is created by fresh groundwater flushing back into that zone that the plume once occupied. And it's that trailing gradient that we're often very interested in as far as monitored natural attenuation, because that's essentially the pendulum moving back to its natural position. Another important thing to understand as far as attenuation processes in groundwater is the relative time scales. And the next few slides will show relative time scales of various types of attenuation processes and in relation to groundwater. So things like sorption or ion exchange reactions that are attenuation mechanisms typically occur on very short time scales of seconds, minutes, in some cases hours, but are very short. Precipitation and co-precipitation tend to take longer to happen. There are kinetic barriers that sometimes that keep things from precipitating rapidly, but those can occur on hours, minutes to hours to months. If we move to slide 45 now, we'll add in to that timeline solid phase transformations. Solid phase transformations are often things like when a contaminant precipitates into a mineral. It often initially is an amorphous substance, doesn't have a strong crystalline structure, and over time a solid phase transformation will occur and it'll become more and more crystalline and less soluble. Those types of reactions tend to occur on the scale of months to years. Then there's radioactive decay. Well, radioactive decay occurs across the entire spectrum of time. So from seconds, in the case of radon, to billions of years, in the case of uranium-238. So it occurs across all time scales. Well, then you compare those various reactions to the time scales of surface water movement and groundwater movement. Surface water movement tends to be relatively rapid compared to groundwater movement. Groundwater movement tends to be in the range of years to get from a initial contamination point to an exposure point. And so one needs to consider the various attenuation processes and how fast they occur in terms of how fast that groundwater is moving. So if the attenuation process occurs rapidly relative to the groundwater process, then it's a viable attenuation mechanism. If it occurs very slowly compared to the groundwater movement, then it's probably not a viable attenuation mechanism. So let's kind of take what we've learned and go to slide 48 and kind of piece things together about what overall controls contaminant transport. And this would be the kinds of things that would go into a conceptual model of what's controlling contaminant transport. And the first thing is the nature of the contaminant source. So the amount of contamination released or its mass obviously is very important. The form it's released in is very important. If it's released as a solution, as opposed to being released from a solid slowly leaching out of a landfill, there are, of course, physical constraints, and in the infiltration rate of water affects the contaminant transport as well as groundwater flow. The chemical constraints have been what we've mainly been talking about, which are the contaminant properties itself, how the contaminant reacts, what kind of species of contaminants occur, the aquifer sediment properties, so those mineral surfaces, the kinds of minerals, etc., and the groundwater chemistry, so the EH, pH of the groundwater. There are also microbial constraints. Microbiological reactions often occur and affect contaminant transport. So overall, what really controls contaminant transport when you add all those up and is how does the attenuation capacity represented by those last three bullets of that list, the physical constraints, the chemical constraints, microbiological constraints, how does that compare to the mass loading of the contamination or how much contaminant has been released and is moving through the aquifer? If the attenuation capacity is large, relative to the mass loading, M&A is possible. If the reverse is true, M&A is very unlikely. Slide 49, please. Moving to slide 49, I just wanted to mention microbial reactions again. Microbes affect those oxidation reduction reactions that we've talked about, because microbes use those reactions to gain energy. But it's important to note that they can only affect reactions that are thermodynamically favorable. But what they can do is take a reaction that normally would take years to occur and speed it up to a point where it may take days to weeks to occur. So microbes can either directly or indirectly change the valence states of contaminants by affecting or speeding up those reaction rates. And the result of that is often a large change in solubility or adsorption, and hence a change in mobility. An example would be something like uranium, which if uranium is moving and it's oxidized, it's very mobile. If it moves into a wetlands where conditions are reducing, microbial reactions occur, are occurring to keep those conditions reducing in the wetlands, and uranium will precipitate as a +4, mineral. Well, Jennifer mentioned, characterization and the things that need to, some of the things that needed to be, considered in characterization. And one of the things, when we start thinking about these redox reactions, one of the things that we need to be careful about when doing sampling and site characterization is making sure we preserve the conditions that the samples originated at. So if you're taking a core sample from 200 feet and bringing it to the surface, it might have been in a very reducing environment, but when you bring it to the surface, you're introducing it to oxygen, and if it sits there or you put it in a jar with oxygen, it's going to oxidize. And that can change the form of the contaminant, or it can change the form of other minerals that can are important to contaminant attenuation. So that it's important to adequately preserve samples, or you can get very misleading results. And if we move to slide 51, there are a couple of examples of that. On the right, is top right, is an example of zinc sulfide. So a sample that was taken where the contaminant was zinc, a core sample was taken, and the original state of the sample, or the sample in its natural, or the state that it was in the core or in the subsurface, is moved to the surface, it's exposed to oxygen, that zinc sulfide that the zinc was bound up in dissolves, and the zinc is released, and when zinc is measured in the pore water, it's often the attenuation capacity of the aquifer can often be very grossly underestimated. A reverse example is arsenic. In the case of arsenic sorbing onto ferric oxides or iron oxides, if a sample was reducing and you brought that sample up to the surface, if it was a groundwater sample that had reduced iron and reduced arsenic in it, exposed to oxygen, the iron oxides, or the iron, the reduced iron is going to oxidize and precipitate, and the arsenic is likely to sorb to that iron hydroxide that precipitates. So when you measure the arsenic in the sample, you're going to get a high arsenic concentration, or a misleading estimate of the capacity of the aquifer to attenuate that arsenic. Well, let's finally move on to this example of nickel precipitating in an iron sulfide. So we see in slide 52 the reaction of co-precipitation of nickel in an iron sulfide. So we have dissolved iron and nickel and hydrogen sulfide that combine to produce this iron sulfide, where a small portion of that iron sulfide, nickel is substituting for the iron. And that's a viable mechanism for nickel attenuation in a reducing aquifer. So what we need to do to understand that is understand some things about the site itself, and we go and we collect data. We collect the site characterization data, hydrology, the plume mapping, geochemistry, etc. We hopefully have taken our samples and preserved them so that correctly, so that they don't change in the bottles. And we do analytical or spectroscopic techniques to analyze the contaminants and the soil minerals to understand something about how the contaminants are sorbed to soil minerals. And we can do bench scale tests or look at the capacity of those soils to absorb nickel. And in the site characterization, there are certain questions that we are trying to answer. One is, is the ambient groundwater pH significantly different than the plume pH? That's important because that gets to how reversible this precipitation of nickel sulfide is. And we can get to that with background data on the groundwater, laboratory tests of the soils at different pHs to see if the nickel is released, etc. We need to understand what the source of the iron 2 and the sulfide is, and are those sources abundant enough to account for co-precipitation of all the nickel. In other words, that's that mass loading versus attenuation capacity question. Do you have enough iron and sulfide in the system to overcome the mass of nickel in the system? And also, we would want to know if the source is from microbial reduction. If it is from microbial reduction, so the source of iron and sulfur, we need to know if there's a significant or a sufficient enough supply of carbon or an electron donor to keep that microbial process going. So again, we would do certain sample analyses to understand these things. We would understand, is there sulfate or dissolved sulfide and the amount of iron in the groundwater by a groundwater analysis using either spectroscopic methods or in some cases even wet chemical methods are still used. We'd want to know if iron sulfide is really present in the aquifer. We suspect that the nickel has co-precipitated the iron sulfide. Now we want to go look for that iron sulfide. And we could do that with something like an acid volatile sulfide analysis. And if we find the iron sulfide in there, we want to know, is the nickel truly associated with the iron sulfide? And we could do that with extraction or looking at the iron sulfide with electron microscopes that have the capability to do chemical analyses. And then we'd want to know if how easily that nickel is released from that iron sulfide when it's exposed to groundwater oxygen or dissolved oxygen in groundwater. And we'd go to laboratory tests to measure that using the soil and exposing it to different dissolved oxygen levels and measuring the nickel release. And those bench scale tests can consist of a variety of things to answer a variety of questions. They will answer, does nickel co-precipitate with iron sulfide under groundwater conditions? How fast? Because that becomes important depending on how fast groundwater is moving. I mentioned we want to know if nickel is released from the iron sulfide when it's exposed to oxygen. And we can do the lab test to measure that. We can also measure in the lab. We can introduce fluxes of iron and sulfide to see if it captures nickel. And that gives us a good indication that that attenuation process of co-precipitation of nickel in iron sulfide is a viable process. So that's just an example of the types of things we might do to get at some of this important chemistry. And that all feeds back into the framework on slide 56, and that piece of the framework showing the source, the plume, the remedy, and various feedback loops. And with that, I'll turn it over to Karen for module 3.
Before we get to Karen, let's take a short break for questions. Thanks, Miles, for filling in, and we really appreciate that.
Certainly.
On slide 57, we do have our question and answer break slide. For our phone line audience, you're welcome to ask questions out loud. You need to unmute your phone, both at your location and by selecting *6 to unmute using our system. For simulcast participants, it's the orange question mark button at the top of the slide that's going to allow you to send in questions. A reminder, for the next section of the training, we are going to go through a decision framework, and that is available as figure 3-1 on page 48 of our guidance document associated with today's training class. If you download the document, you'll have that on page 48. If not, in your original registration confirmation, we did include a one-page PDF of it. That one-page PDF is also available on our links to additional resources page. So from your confirmation email, you can go to the main training page again, and then on the left, it'll take you to the links page. And on the links, it's the third item listed. During the next section of the training, we are going to go through that decision framework, and we found it's useful to have a one-page version of that available in the audience so that you can walk through with us. Again, for our phone line audience, remember to unmute your phone and select *6 at your location. And when you ask a question, please state the name and your name and where you're calling in from. Do we have questions to start from our phone line audience?
Yes, this is Fritz Krems in, with Trihydro in Evergreen, Colorado. On slide 53, the speaker was saying that if the source of reduction of metals is microbially mediated, you should make sure there's enough carbon in the system to keep that going. How would you suggest practitioners assess whether or not something is a microbial reaction as opposed to something else?
Let me unmute there. There's actually a variety of ways. I mean, one would be to look to have microbial analyses done of the actual microbes there to see if the proper microbes are there, if you have sulfate-reducing microbes. If you wanted, there are techniques of looking at the sulfur isotopes to assess whether a sulfide that's been precipitated is microbially formed, or you could look at, if you're looking at, you know, is there, is the carbon being reduced by the microbes, which is creating reducing conditions, you can look at things like carbon isotopes of CO2 or methane in the system. Does that answer your question? Or?
Yes, thank you.
We have a question from the simulcast audience that refers to slide 22. So if you're using the Cluin system, along the left is a list of slide numbers, and you can jump back to slide 22. The question is, slide 22, bullet 1, is source removal really a requirement for MNA, e.g. mass flux reduction in lieu of complete removal?
This is Jennifer. The 1999 EPA Oswald Directive does specify that source treatment is a prerequisite to MNA as long as there is still mass coming off the source. What we've seen is that, yes, reducing the mass discharge off the source is an acceptable approach to this, but that's still some active treatment typically. And so when you're looking at MNA, it is really important to look at the overall mass balance and to look at a comparison of the mass that is still being discharged from the source after a source treatment or mass reduction, mass flux reduction, and then compare that to the attenuation capacity that's in the downgradient aquifer.
Thank you. Let's go ahead and move on to the next section of our training. If we have time at the end, we'll get back to more questions. If you have taken your phone off of mute, a reminder that it's *6 to toggle back between mute and unmute. Also, if you leave before we wrap up the class today, the last slide has a link to our feedback form. And we do look for everyone on the call today to fill out the feedback form. So please take a few minutes to give us your feedback before you leave the training site. On slide 58, we're going to continue on with the second half of our training class. And I'm going to turn the presentation over to Karen Vangelis from the Savannah River National Lab. Karen?
Thank you, Juliana. We're now at slide 58, and I'd like to begin our walkthrough of the decision framework. We found that this framework is a useful tool when evaluating sites with metals and radionuclides in groundwater. But before we jump into the framework, I wanted to start with a quick recap of Module 2, and so let's go to slide 59. Now, if you're like me and you're not a geochemist or you haven't looked at a chemistry textbook in a while, Module 2 can be a bit overwhelming. So I thought I would list a few key points from that module that would be helpful for you to keep in mind as we walk through the decision framework, or really if you're just looking at sites with metals and radionuclides in general. So metals are not destroyed, as Miles said, and many of the radionuclides of concern have sufficiently long half-lives that they can be considered as not being destroyed, at least in the context of what we're talking about today. And so because of that, you can either remove the contaminants from the subsurface, or they're going to remain in the subsurface in one form or another, as you heard Miles talk about in Module 2. The attenuation processes also tend to be reversible, and that there are several controlling factors, such as pH, oxidation reduction potential, and presence-absence of iron. And what this really gets to is the contaminants that are mobile or toxic under one set of subsurface geochemical conditions may become immobile or less toxic under a different set of subsurface geochemical conditions, or vice versa. But eventually all waste sites are going to return to their natural state. And thus the goal, if metals and radionuclides are going to remain in the subsurface, is first to ensure that, well, at least to the best of our ability, they're going to be in an immobile or less toxic form over the long term. In other words, when the conditions return to natural or background state. So where you may want to begin is looking at what that natural state is potentially going to look like, and will the contaminants be stable at that state. Let's go to slide 60. The goal of the flowchart is to provide you a roadmap that's going to facilitate developing a defensible conceptual site model that will support the transitioning of technologies and will incorporate the US EPA's four-tiered process for evaluating M&A. And, as necessary, we want to be able to incorporate sustainable remedial alternatives that are defined as enhanced attenuation. Let's move to slide 61. On this slide, we show the flowchart on the left, and this was provided to you as an attachment to the email invitation to today's training, as Juliana mentioned earlier. Also, if you have our tech reg document in front of you, you can find the flowchart on figure 3.1, and it's also available on the attenuation processes for metals and radionuclides public webpage, and the email or the web address is the second bullet on this slide. What I would like you to think about as we go through this is that many sites have more than one contaminant. And so individual contaminants, metals, may behave differently to a single geochemical environment. Thus, movement through this flow chart and the effective treatment technologies may be unique to the particular contaminant. Let's go to slide 62. Before we delve into the details of the flow chart, I'd like to spend a minute or two looking at the flow chart as a whole. You've seen this several times in the presentation. Ann introduced it, and Miles referred to it also. At this level, the flow chart is identical to the decision flow chart that was developed by the Enhanced Attenuation Chlorinated Organics team and documented in their tech reg document that was published in 2008. Of course, the difference are in the details, and we're going to get to those in a few minutes. But essentially, for all of us who've been in this business for any length of time, we recognize that it's a rare sight where you go once through characterization, remediation selection, implementation, and you're successfully meeting your remediation goals. So the framework was built recognizing this need for an iterative process. It was also built to allow entry and exit where it meets the needs. For example, if M&A is an ongoing remedy at the site and it's not performing well, you could jump into the framework at the M&A evaluation section. And that evaluation, based on the EPA's tiered process, may provide valuable insight as to what is keeping success at bay. It also could enlighten you as to whether an enhanced attenuation or source treatment should be targeted as your next step. Jennifer mentioned in Module 1, contingency planning is paramount to this entire process. What you'll note, if you've looked at the flowchart, is that we only identify contingency planning specifically in two locations, but it is inherent throughout the whole process. Lastly, the framework emphasizes a systems approach, and Anne brought this up in the introduction. But by using a systems approach, we're recognizing that the actions in the source may impact downgradient sectors of the plume, and that information gathered in a downgradient sector may be useful in evaluating and selecting your remediation approaches, both upgrading and downgrading of that sector. That sort of relates to the discussion Miles had about reversibility as conditions change. Let's go on to slide 63. In this slide, you've seen this before. We're going back to Miles' discussion in Module 2 of Wayside Evolution. The goal is to develop a plan that will implement remedies in combination to facilitate the return to natural conditions. The bullets on the left are just, the first two are just ways to coin the concept. Important, though, in this evaluation is determining if the contaminants will be stable at the site background conditions. Now, one thing we all need to recognize is that when you've bathed the subsurface in a highly acidic waste for 30 years, there's going to be irreversible geochemical changes to the subsurface soils. However, you can use your background conditions as an early starting point for your evaluation to provide valuable information on the likelihood for a sustainable remediation. Let's go on to slide 64. Now that we've talked about the goals and the logic associated with the framework, I'd like to spend a few minutes on some key features. First and foremost, along the left-hand side, we have integrated the US EPA's four-tiered approach for M&A. The framework in support of that four-tiered approach provides a focused approach to data collection. Also, the framework was built on the philosophy of starting with what you know and then collecting that data that will complete the picture. You actually may have quite a bit of information to begin your analysis, more than you realize. Let's go on to slide 65. Now, if you're not familiar with the EPA's four tiers, this is a graphical representation from their guidance document. Usually, Tier 1 is asking the question, is the plume stable or shrinking? Tier 2 is identifying the attenuation mechanisms that are occurring now. Tier 3, we're looking to determine if those mechanisms will be stable and if the attenuation capacity will be sustainable over the long term. So now you're making projections as to what is going to happen in the future. In Tier 4, we're designing the performance monitoring plan and the contingency plan based on those mechanisms that are stable and sustainable. So essentially, Tier 1, 2, 3 leads you to a reduction in uncertainty. If you want more information on these four tiers, I recommend you go to the EPA documents. We provided the reference on slide 19. Also, in slides 52 to 55, when Miles gave the example near the end of his presentation, he essentially walked you through an example of someone going through the Tier 1 to Tier 3 analysis. Well, now let's go to slide 66, and we'll begin walking through the framework. Through this module, we are going to use an example from the Savannah River site that Jennifer introduced in module 1 to try to bring the framework to a real site. But as Ann mentioned early on, you need to recognize that the work at this site, along with all the case studies that are highlighted in section 6 of our tech reg document, were conducted prior to the development of the framework. So if you have the framework page out, we're going to begin at the top of the framework, work down the left-hand column, and then complete the discussion related to enhanced attenuation, which is on the right-hand side of the column. So slide 66 begins us with source and primary plume treatment. And here our assumption is that you already have some data because a source and possibly even a plume have been identified. There may be cases where the regulators had required source treatments, so you may have even additional information. But something to think about in this box is that we typically think of the source as the location where the contaminants are found in the subsurface in a concentrated volume, which is close to the point of discharge. But for metals and radionuclides, you may have both primary and secondary sources. As you cross these geochemical gradients that Miles discussed in Module 2, you may have zones where contaminants were immobilized, and as these gradients progress, the contaminants, now that's essentially a secondary source, and those may become mobile. For your radionuclides, the secondary source could be a daughter product, and those could be located spatially with the primary source or down gradient. So just something additional to keep in mind relative to metals and radionuclides. Now I'd like to go to slide 67, which is our example. Jennifer introduced this. In addition to strontium and uranium, iodine is also a contaminant of concern at this location. The source was three earthen basins that received acidic waste from processing operations for about a 30-year period before operations were discontinued. And the source treatments that were selected and implemented were to stabilize the basin soils and cap those basins, as well as implement a groundwater pump and treat system. And the photo showed the before and after capping of those basins. Now, we'll discuss the site in greater detail throughout this module. You can also find additional information in Section 6 of our document, as well as Appendix A. On to slide 68. Okay, back to the decision flow chart. In this box, items to be looked at are, is the treatment facilitating a return to background conditions? You're also asking yourself, are the contaminants stabilized with the treatment that is occurring? And if so, how permanent is that action? Because these contaminants are not destroyed, we are looking for long-term stabilization. Also, what is the impact on the naturally occurring metals? This is something we probably aren't thinking about too much with organics. Because even if these metals are not contaminants, if you mobilize them, they may have an impact on the mobilization or stabilization of the contaminants. Slide 69. Let's jump back to the Savannah River site example. Reminding you, the original treatments were the capping of the basins and installing and operating a pump and treat system. As they went into their evaluation phase of the source and primary plume treatment, how it was affecting their system, they found that the contaminants of concern were continuing to reach the compliance points. Also of concern, and Jennifer mentioned this, is that there was a generation of a secondary waste stream as part of that pump and treat system, and it was to the tune of about $1 million per month. On to slide 70. Now we're in the tier process, tiers 1 through 4, and we'll quickly walk through each of those tiers. In tier 1, we've got characterization and evaluation efforts that most of us are pretty comfortable with. We're looking at contaminant concentration and distribution, groundwater and contaminant flow rates and paths. But we can also begin evaluating the biogeochemical evolution of the site. So here we have opportunities to start looking at those controlling parameters that Miles mentioned in Module 2, pH, redox potential, iron content, and how the contaminants will be affected by the evolution of those parameters as the plume moves through the system and the clean groundwater comes back into the system once that trailing gradient passes out of the system. I also wanted to mention that in tables 2.5 and 2.6 on page 46 and 47 of our TechReg document, we summarize some of the analytical techniques that are commonly used in evaluating natural attenuation of contaminants for groundwater and aquifer solids. And these analyses may be useful in the Tier 1 and Tier 2 analysis. On to slide 71. Here in Tier 2, we're focusing on the current conditions and determining if the rates of attenuation are currently of the mechanisms currently dominant will support reaching the goals in a reasonable time frame. Here we're gathering data to delineate the geochemical gradients that are present in the system and to identify what those dominant mechanisms that are controlling the attenuation of the contaminants are. An example of a geochemical gradient is when you transition from an upland unit to a wetland setting. You're likely to have a redox gradient. So the decision related to this action box to Tier 2 is, do the attenuation rates support a reasonable time frame? There was a long discussion in the team on what's reasonable and should we define that, and we decided that in reality that term is defined by the decision makers at each particular site. So as you answer that, your decision-making parties will be involved, and if you answer no at this point, the framework sends you to the enhanced attenuation section of the flow chart. If you answer yes, you will continue on to Tier 3. And we will move to slide 72. So in Tier 3, we're evaluating the future stability of the mechanisms and the capacity of the system to attenuate the contaminants. This is where we start incorporating our knowledge of the trailing gradient that Miles presented on slide 43 of Module 2. Conditions that will exist once that trailing gradient passes are going to be the conditions that will determine the long-term stability of the contaminants. And so this evaluation will require making educated projections, because the subsurface, as we all know, is a dynamic system, and the long-lived nature of these contaminants may require remediations for hundreds to tens of thousands of years. Thus, you know, certainty is really a given in making these projections, and again, our feeling is that the decision-making parties for a site are going to have to agree upon what is that acceptable uncertainty. So the decisions related to the mechanism stability and capacity are, is the system capacity sufficient, and is the contaminant stability sufficient? A no to either one of these will send you to an enhanced attenuation evaluation. A yes will take you to Tier 4 and slide 73. So now we've gone through the technical evaluation, and we'll say we've been successful, and monitor natural attenuation as a viable portion of the remedy. So we're ready to begin designing the performance monitoring program to ensure the attenuation mechanisms are continuing to operate as predicted, and we will develop a contingency plans in the event the remedy doesn't perform as expected. Because we're using an approach here that integrates the actions of the entire system from source to the distal end of the plume, we have a really unique opportunity to use multiple metrics in defining success. We recognize the contaminant concentrations are going to continue to be central to all monitoring programs. However, there's becoming a greater understanding of how contaminant flux can be used to support the evaluation of successful treatment technologies and to indicate when it may be appropriate time to transition from an active to a passive treatment. The ITRC's Integrated Dean Applesite Strategy Team recently published a technical document on this topic. You can find that document on the ITRC's webpage. That team is also giving internet-based training on this document. The reference for their document is with the notes for this slide, and if you check CLUIN, you can find the most recent dates for their internet-based training. Slide 74. So now our next step in the process, we're near getting close to the bottom of the left-hand side of the framework, is looking at the regulatory criteria and have we met those criteria for the program under which your site is regulated. And on this slide are typical criteria that are looked at. Are risks acceptable? Is remediation time frame acceptable? Are cost benefits acceptable? If these criteria are met, then you've met the technical basis for an M&A remedy. And we can go to slide 75. Now we're at probably the longest part of the process. M&A is part of your remedy. And so now you're going to begin evaluating the performance of that remedy. Because the attenuation of metals and radionuclides are strongly influenced by the evolution of that wayside of those geochemical conditions, monitoring should include those conditions that can be important precursors to measuring mobilized contaminants. For example, pH may be a key parameter and an easily measured parameter to give you a hint that something's going to be changing in your system and you may have the potential of your contaminants remobilizing. Slide 76. So we've completed our introduction to the left-hand side of the flowchart, and I'd like to move over to the right-hand side in the enhanced attenuation section. We're going to go through this real briefly because some of the steps really are mimic the ones on the left-hand side, especially the performance evaluation. If you've been introduced to the concept of enhanced attenuation through the Enhanced Attenuation Chlorinated Organics team and their tech reg document and their training, then you're going to be familiar with the definition and description and defined enhanced attenuation, and I'll just quickly go over that again. But enhanced attenuation technologies are really transition technologies. They're seen as a bridge between the active remediation technologies and M&A enclosure. They are engineered remedies. The goal is to support and augment the natural attenuation processes that may not be fast enough or sufficient, with the intent of using low energy and long lasting approaches. The design and selection of these technologies is based on those criteria that were not satisfactorily met when you were performing the M&A evaluation on the left-hand side of the chart. Let's go to slide 77. In our document, we chose to keep our discussion of enhanced attenuation to a real introductory level, and we just introduced the classes of enhanced attenuation and the types of technologies that fit within those classes, as you see here on this figure. As you'll note from the figure, enhanced attenuation technologies either focus on reducing source loading through hydraulic manipulation or residual source reduction, or increasing the stability of the contaminants and or the attenuation capacity of the system. Now let's move to slide 78. So now we come back to the Savannah Riverside example, where we had our three contaminants of concern that were reaching the compliance points, and the site owners recognized that they needed to take alternative actions. These three contaminants, strontium, uranium, and iodine, while all being pH controlled, the mechanisms were slightly different, and so for two technologies, or two contaminants, excuse me, the strontium and the uranium, the base injection technology, which Jennifer described, was implemented to stabilize those two contaminants at near background pH conditions, but there was no impact on the iodine. So that technology is in full operation at this point. However, the operating organization is developing an enhanced attenuation approach to facilitate stabilizing the iodine so that it will remain immobile once that trailing gradient passes. So when I asked you to think about what would happen with the two, if you had multiple contaminants, how you would work your way through the flow chart, that was on slide 61. This is an example of where there are two enhanced attenuation technologies to address three contaminants of concern, and we have one that's in full operation and the performance monitoring stage is in effect at this point, and the other one is still in the development stage. So you can see that it is possible to be in two places at that flow chart at the same time and have different technologies that you will need to implement to address your contaminants. So let's go to slide 79. So in summary, the framework provides a decision process for identifying sustainable remedial alternatives by looking at the source, dissolved contaminants in the distal edge of the plume, as a complete system. While we integrate the four-tiered evaluation approach for M&A that was published by the US EPA, and it provides the logic for integrating enhanced attenuation technologies as needed. So this concludes Module 3, and I will now turn the training over to Ann Charles with the New Jersey Department of Environmental Protection. Ann?
Thanks, Karen. And let's go ahead and turn to slide 80. You'll see we're at the conclusion section of the training, so I'm just going to quickly recap. Slide 81, please. We talked about regulations and guidance, and there is a lot of variability of state regulations, guidance, and policy. Jennifer presented to you the results of surveys that our team conducted, and we went through the advantages as well as the challenges that regulators consider when evaluating M&A as a remedial option. Take-home point from all the speakers, metals and rads are long-lived contaminants. When you're evaluating M&A as a remedy for your site, you have to be thinking about sustainability and reversibility. And another important consideration for the regulated community and regulators is contingency planning. Contingency planning provides you with knowledge of what to do down the road if the M&A remedy isn't working as projected. Let's go ahead to slide 82. Your next module was the refresher on geochemistry. Attenuation processes are different for metals and rads than for organics. For metals, the dominant attenuation processes at most sites are sorption, precipitation, or co-precipitation. For radionuclides, what you're looking at is radioactive decay. Miles also discussed reactions that can take place when the contaminant plume enters an aquifer, so you need to be considering the natural minerals of the aquifer, the groundwater chemistry of the natural aquifer pore water, and the chemical composition of the contaminant plume. Now, since metals and rads are not physically destroyed, you also must ensure that the attenuation is long-lasting and that a robust long-term monitoring plan is employed. Slide 83, please. And Karen just presented to you in Module 3 that decision framework process. The framework helps you to understand the interrelationship between the source, the plume, and the applicability of M&A. So for M&A, you're likely going to need a more intensive effort on characterization in order to understand the attenuation processes involved and evaluate if the attenuation mechanisms can be sustained over time. The framework guides you through a series of decisions to help you assess whether the remedy is appropriate, whether it's working, and some suggestions of what you can do if it isn't working as projected. But remember, this is an iterative process. Your site specifics may warrant further characterization, or it may be that your site might need some sort of enhanced attenuation to help transition the site from an engineered remedy into more of an attenuation-based remedy. Slide 84, please. So in summary, through today's training, you've learned about the decision framework to provide you with a technically defensible process to evaluate M&A as a remedial alternative for sites impacted with metals and or rads in groundwater. Our companion guidance document has a lot more information for you than what we could cover today. We do think you'll find it useful as a resource to refer to as you go through your own site-specific evaluations. So with that, we thank you for your time, and let's go ahead to slide 85, which is our last question and answer session, and I'll turn the presentation back over to Juliana.
Thank you, Ann. Before we get to questions, let's go to our links page and our feedback form. For our simulcast audience, if you'd like to, you're welcome to start sending in questions using the orange question mark button at the top of the slide. You're welcome to either follow the links or the feedback form. If you do go to the links page, if you look to the left, the third item down takes you over to the feedback form. We do ask that everyone on the call today fill out the feedback form. If you have more than one person at your location, one person can fill it out, and then there's a link that will take you back and allow the next people at your location to fill out the feedback form. Looking at the links, the first one listed, download today's ITRC training. This is going to allow you to download the presentation that you've seen. You can either download a PowerPoint or a PDF. In both the downloaded versions, you'll have access to the notes in addition to what was on the slides. Today's training introduced the ITRC Technical and Regulatory Guidance Document, a decision framework for applying monitored natural attenuation processes to metals and rads in groundwater. This link is going to take you over to the ITRC website where you can download a PDF version of this document. And we do encourage you to review the document itself now that you've heard about it. Also, through Section 1, we have additional items from the ITRC website. This is just a sample of what's available on the ITRC websites and things that we've talked about during today's class. There's much more information available on the ITRC website, and we do encourage you to review it to see if it's something you can use. In Section 2, we list additional resources that you may find useful. We do now want to take time for questions. So for our simulcast audience, it's back on the slides. It's the orange question mark button that allows you to ask questions. For our phone line, you are welcome to ask questions out loud. You need to unmute your phone, both at your location, and select *6 to unmute using our system. That's *6 to unmute using our system. And when you ask a question, please state your name and location you're calling in from. Do we have questions to start from our phone line audience? From the simulcast, James Graham at NNL in United Kingdom, are there any circumstances where M&A is still viable where an active source exists, e.g. VETUS zone, where release rates could be estimated into future?
This is Jennifer.
Go ahead, Jennifer.
Okay. And I think it is that determination is site-specific. I don't know whether there has been any source treatment, and you're just talking about residual source mass. But we can definitely look at a comparison between the mass discharge coming off of the source and the attenuation rate in the aquifer, as well as the attenuation capacity to make a natural attenuation assessment. So I guess the short answer is that I would still consider it a potential remedy. Miles, did you want to add anything else?
No, I think Jennifer did fine. It comes back to that issue of mass loading versus attenuation capacity. And if the mass loading, if you can measure that from the VETO zone and it's small compared to the attenuation capacity, then it is probably a viable remedy.
And this is Ann, again, with the, you know, as the regulator, you also need to be considering your receptors that might be impacted by that particular plume. So that's also a factor to be taking into consideration.
For Michael Lee at Terra Systems in Wilmington, Delaware, can you provide an example of a site and contaminants and conditions where M&A is likely to be successful, and for conditions where M&A is likely not to be successful?
This is Jennifer. So I can give one example of an instance where we successfully applied M&A to arsenic in groundwater. This is a site that people in my company worked on, and arsenic was being released down gradient from a landfill as a result of the introduction of carbon into the groundwater from the landfill that was causing mildly reducing conditions, which mobilized naturally occurring arsenic from the solids into groundwater. And once the groundwater progressed down gradient and reached more oxidizing conditions, the arsenic also oxidized and dropped out of solution. So we demonstrated that the NO receptors were going to be impacted as a result of the short distance of arsenic mobilization and immobilization, and we demonstrated the immobilization process, and we're currently monitoring it. But M&A was successfully used and approved and accepted for that site. And then just a quick example of an instance where M&A definitely would not be used is if you have a plume that's expanding. So if we see a plume footprint, for example, that's expanding in an area, then M&A is just not going to be an acceptable standalone remedy there.
Thank you. From William Pickens at MWH in Denver, Colorado, regarding slide 75, and as a reminder, if you use an inclusion system, along the left is a list of slide numbers, and you can jump back to slide 75. Could you give some examples of how an evaluation could be performed in order to demonstrate that attenuation mechanisms are sustainable over time?
This is Miles. One way to do that is to adopt that philosophy of using remedies that are consistent with the natural geochemistry of the site. So if you know the site is going to return to close to its natural conditions, and you can prove in the lab or with field tests such as push-pull tests or things in the field, can prove that the attenuation mechanisms are going to remain viable at those final geochemical conditions, that's probably the best way. Short of that, there are people have tried lab studies where they have tried to simulate long-term aging of sites. Some of those, I'm not sure of that those have been particularly successful, but I think the best way is just to make sure the remedy is consistent with the final state, geochemical state you would expect to have at that site.
Thank you. For our phone line audience, remember to unmute your line, both at your location, and select *6 to unmute using our system. And when you ask a question, please state your name and location you're calling in from. Any questions from the phone line? I do want to wait a few more minutes just to be sure that we've gotten all the questions that we're going to get. While we're waiting, I'll remind you about some upcoming training classes. On October 18, our class is Permeable Reactive Barrier Technology Update. On November 3, the class is Use and Measurement of Mass Flux and Mass Discharge. So we've mentioned this topic several times during today's class. And on November 3, we're offering internet-based training. There's also the document that's available on the links page that you can go look at immediately. On November 10, our class is Project Risk Management for Site Remediation. November 15, Development of Performance Specifications for Solidification Stabilization. November 17, Use of Risk Assessment and Management of Contaminated Sites. And November 29, Mine Waste Treatment Technology Selection. More information about all of these classes is available on the ITRC website, www.itrcweb.org. You can read more about the upcoming classes. You can find the links to the documents. You can register for classes. And if you don't want to wait, there's archives available of past classes. So in an archive, you can see the slides and listen to a recorded version of the instructors. Do we have any additional questions from our phone line audience? It looks like we are out of questions for today's call. I'd like to thank our instructors and our participants for joining us today. If you have not already, please fill out that feedback form. It's information we use, and we really do appreciate you taking just a few minutes to give us your feedback. For more information, visit the ITRC website at www.itrcweb.org. Thanks again for joining us, and have a great day.